This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran says it will return to the talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal after reviewing the details of previous negotiations, calling illegal sanctions the biggest issue. Venezuela is set to reopen its border with Colombia after a nearly three-year closure due to diplomatic tensions. Also ahead, the UK government says it could abandon a post-Brexit trade accord for Northern Ireland in the next 4 weeks unless the EU agrees to wholesale changes. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran has reiterated its readiness to return to the talks aimed at salvaging the 2015 nuclear deal, but says the country has first to review the minutes of the previous rounds of the Vienna talks. The Foreign Ministry spokesman, Said Khatibzadeh, said the talks could be resumed by early November. He said, however, that the biggest issue in his view is the removal of 800 illegal and unilateral sanctions imposed by former US President Donald Trump after he pulled his country out of the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Iran and the remaining signatories have held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital since April in order to revive the 2015 deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The talks stopped in June pending the start of Iran's new government. Emeritus Professor Frank Emspach earlier joined us with his take on the Iran nuclear deal revival talks and the factors that might hamper the progress in that direction.
I think that here in this country, given all the pressures on the Biden administration for their domestic agenda and the issues about the stability of the government and the paying of the bills and so on and so forth, I don't think until these things are resolved here that we're going to see much in the way of initiatives in the foreign policy realm. And but there's time to do that. I mean, this is just the beginning of October. Now, as far as the sanctions are concerned, obviously the United States position is going to have to be modified. But I believe here again that this is partially a responsibility of the Europeans, that there's going to have to be some serious political independence on the part of Europe saying to the United States, enough is enough here, we're making progress. I don't see that right now. And now that's a source of concern in terms of how these talks are going to proceed. So I think that a lot of these things are related. And I think that without pressure from people, from the political left in Europe, and here in the Democratic Party left, that we're not going to make very much progress. With that pressure, and perhaps with the settling of the issues here domestically, then there's a chance.
Hundreds of Pakistani officials, including former and sitting ministers, have been found to have hidden their illegal wealth in offshore companies abroad. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has called for an investigation into new documents which have exposed the hidden wealth of many world leaders in a similar fashion. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
Pakistani politicians and former top civilian and military officials are in the spotlight after they were named in Pandora Papers scandal. There are as many as 700 Pakistani politicians, retired civilian and military officials whose names surfaced in the scandal. Among them also included sitting ministers and close aide to the Prime Minister Imran Khan, whose government came into power in 2018 with a pledge to end rampant corruption. Pandora Papers are based on 11.9 million documents from 14 firms, mostly in British Virgin Islands in the U.S., where many world leaders and top officials, including from Pakistan, hid their allegedly ill-gotten money by setting up anonymous offshore companies.
How ironic it is. Look at the sheer numbers of military generals and bureaucrats and members of current government who have been named in Pandora leak. They all are involved in this mega corruption.
Prime Minister Imran Khan has ordered an investigation into the scandal.
Although Mr. Imran Khan has been presiding over a team of these crooks and gangsters who have now been exposed in these Pandora's leaks, he has been closely working with these ministers whose names have come up. But at the same time, he would like to distance himself from these crooks and gangsters in the name of the so-called investigation that he's likely to initiate very soon.
Prime Minister Imran Khan's predecessor Nawaz Sharif was ousted from power in 2017 for possessing overseas assets beyond known means of their income after a similar scandal known as Panama Papers surfaced. Since then, many tax amnesty schemes have been introduced to legalize the hidden wealth of politicians and officials in and outside Pakistan in return of tax penalties. Therefore, many believe the corrupt elements are likely to get scot-free once again. Pandora Papers scandal is likely to die down in Pakistan given the fact that this time around the powerful military seems to have no appetite to play its role to oust the current government, unlike in 2017 when the military fully backed the judiciary to oust the then Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif after he clashed with the army on issues linked with the foreign policy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Venezuela says it will reopen its border with Colombia on Tuesday after a nearly three-year closure due to diplomatic tensions between the two neighbors. The Venezuelan Vice President, Delcy Rodriguez, said the decision to open the border has been taken in view of brotherhood and cooperation between the people of Colombia and Venezuela. Colombian President Iván Duque echoed the call, saying he has also ordered officials to begin the reopening process as soon as possible. He said the move would benefit people of both countries. Caracas closed the border in February 2019 amid tensions over Colombia's recognition of Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido as interim president. Trade between the two countries once amounted to some $7 billion per year before the border closure. Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. China has lashed out at the United States for selling arms to Taiwan and sending its warships to the Taiwan Strait. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman called Washington's actions provocative and irresponsible. Hua Chunying said the U.S. should abide by the One China principle, urging Washington to stop bolstering Taiwanese separatist forces. The remarks came after the U.S. State Department, in a statement, asked China to cease its military, diplomatic, and economic pressure against Taiwan. It also criticized Beijing's recent military drills near the self-ruled island, calling them destabilizing activities and undermining regional peace. China regards Taiwan a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. The U.S. is Taiwan's largest weapons supplier, despite having no formal ties with the island. Joining us is Ina Tengen, author and the columnist from Beijing, and we also have Lawrence Davison, former lecturer at Westchester University, joining us out of Westchester. Gentlemen, welcome. And if we go to Beijing first, Ina, Washington acknowledges the One China policy, yet it continues to arm Taiwan to the teeth. Why do you think that is?
It's a part of a wider containment policy. It's not just Taiwan. It's also Xinjiang, Hong Kong, Tibet, South China Seas, And then you get into the economic realm where there's continuous war in terms of technology, now bleeding over into finance. The U.S. believes that by giving China, keeping it preoccupied with its borders and also its economy, that it can somehow keep China's rise down. It hasn't worked. This was the main premise that Donald Trump came in with. It has not been successful. In fact, the U.S. deficit with China, trade deficit, has expanded by over 30% over the last few years, far higher than it was when Donald Trump started. Yet the U.S. under Joseph Biden persists in this direction. The real danger here is that Taiwan is a red line for China, and the U.S. keeps treating it as if it's some sort of diplomatic card that they can play. The danger is escalation that could lead literally to an outbreak of an armed outbreak.
Lawrence, if I can just switch over to you, you know, Washington's calling on Beijing to stop undermining regional peace, but then the U.S. keeps sending warships to China's backyard, essentially. What do you think the United States' reaction would be to, firstly, isn't that destabilizing regional peace? And then secondly, what would the United States' reaction be if China or Beijing was to send warships to American waters?
Well, they wouldn't like it, obviously. I think that there's a big history, there's a long history here between linking Washington and Taiwan. And it's almost as historically cemented in the minds of American diplomats and American political leaders as China's attitude that Taiwan is somehow a breakaway province. This started in 1948 when Chiang Kai-shek's defeated forces crossed over and took refuge in Taiwan. And the Americans, aided that and helped them establish themselves. So there is a deep, deep connection, and it makes for a very dangerous situation. But Biden, and who's a really old line politician here, you know, this is not just tactical. Though your other speaker is correct that there's a containment aspect to this. But it goes beyond tactical, and it goes beyond even strategy. This is a very, very serious problem, and one should recognize that the American government and the State Department has emotional ties here.
Right, and then Aina, if, for argument's sake, if the United States was to continue boosting separatist forces in Taiwan, do you think there's going to be a time, or do you foresee a time where that Beijing would see that as a red line, and then how would China react to then?
It's already a red line in terms of emotional attachment. I recall that those same ideas were voiced about Pakistan, Iraq, I mean not Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Middle East. But, you know, times change. The fact is the U.S., as my other colleague said, set up Taiwan as an independent ship. It was the one who U.S. government was supporting Chiang Kai-shek. They were providing him arms, trucks, money in order to defeat the communists. When he lost, they provided a safe haven. In terms of this thing, it's in the Chinese constitution that Taiwan is an inseparable part of the mainland. Any attempt to try to change that literally will lead to armed conflict. If you start looking, it's not just the ships, it's the Quad, it's AUKUS, it's sales of nuclear submarines to Australia, It's not just the ships in the Taiwan Straits, but the U.S. presence throughout the South China, East China Seas. It's the 400 bases that the U.S. keeps that surround, in essence, China. These are all provocative acts, and as you pointed out earlier, if the situation was reversed, the U.S. would, in fact, take military action to prevent such an encirclement campaign. Unfortunately, I agree with my colleague, there is a blindness on the U.S. side. They believe that there is only one system in the world, and it's their it justifies everything they do, American exceptionalism. And this is the greatest danger to the world, the arrogance of thinking that only you can provide safety, a political system that works, and that all others must, in fact, bow down to it. It hasn't worked. There are no U.S. military or diplomatic initiatives that have been able to do by force any of the things that the U.S. has said that it's wanted to do in the world, one entity.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Let's thank our guests for their time and contribution. Aina Tengen, author and columnist, joining us live from Beijing, and also Lawrence Davison, former lecturer at Westchester University, joining us out of Westchester. And that brings an end to this edition of the News Review. The UK says it will trigger safeguard measures in the Brexit deal if the European Union doesn't agree to its proposed reforms to the Northern Ireland Protocol.
If we can agree something better, as I would like us to do, we can get back to where we wanted to be, an independent Britain with friendly relations with the EU based on free trade. But we cannot wait forever. Without an agreed solution soon, we will need to act using the Article 16 safeguard mechanism to address the impact the protocol is having in Northern Ireland.
Addressing the Conservative Party conference, Frost said the agreement has, quote, come apart even more quickly than we feared. He said the UK government could abandon a post-Brexit trading accord for Northern Ireland in the next 4 weeks unless the EU agrees to wholesale changes. The EU has already threatened to look at all options in response to such a move. The Northern Ireland Protocol has created massive problems for the region by imposing checks on transit of goods with EU member island. In July, Britain presented a package of reforms and urged the bloc to rewrite the deal, a request that was flatly rejected by Brussels. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We here at IRIB English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the occasion of 28th of Safar, the anniversary of the passing away of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is also the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, the second infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on this day of mourning. in the limelight.
A circus-like review of the 2020 vote commissioned by Arizona Republicans took another wild turn on Friday, 1st of October, when veteran election experts charged at the very foundation of its findings, the results of a hand count of 2.1 million ballots, was based on numbers so unreliable that they appear to be guesswork rather than tabulations. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Michael Wines and Nick Corazzaniti. The piece is titled, Arizona Vote Review Made Up the Numbers, Election Experts Say. Circus-like review of the 2020 vote commission by Arizona Republicans took another wild turn on Friday, 1st of October, when veteran election experts charged that the very foundation of its findings, the results of a hand count of 2.1 million ballots, was based on numbers so unreliable that they appeared to be guesswork rather than tabulations. The organizers of the review made up the numbers. The headline of the experts' report reads, the experts, a data analyst for the Arizona Republican Party and two retired executives of an election consulting firm in Boston, Massachusetts, said in their report that workers for the investigators failed to count thousands of ballots in a pallet of 40 ballot-filled boxes delivered to them in the spring. The final report by the Republican investigators concluded that President Biden actually won 99 more votes than were reported, and that former President Donald Trump tallied 261 fewer votes. But given the large undercount found in just a sliver of the 2.1 million ballots, it would effectively be impossible for the Republican investigators to arrive at such precise numbers, the experts said. Rod Thompson, a spokesman for Cyber Ninjas, the company hired to conduct the inquiry in Arizona, rejected the experts' claim. We stand by our methodology and complete final report, he said. Investigators went through more than 1,600 ballot-filled boxes this summer to conduct their hand recount of the election in Maricopa County, the most populous county in the state. Both they and the Republican-controlled state Senate, which ordered the election inquiry, have refused to disclose the details of the hand count. But a worksheet containing the results of the hand count of 40 of those boxes was included in a final report on the election inquiry released a week ago by Cyber Ninjas. The three election experts said the hand count could have missed thousands or even hundreds of thousands of ballots if all 1,600 boxes of ballots were similarly undercounted. Their findings were earlier reported in the Arizona Republic. For months, the Cyber Ninjas effort had been the lodestar of the conservative movement, the foundational investigation that would uncover a litany of abuses and verify countless conspiracies, proving a stolen election. But the review was criticized from the start for unprofessional and unorthodox methods and partisan influence. Now the experts' findings on the vote review compound withering analysis, debunking a wide range of questions raised in the review about the counting of votes and conduct of the election. Nonetheless, the review has been embraced by Donald Trump and his followers, even as its findings have been overwhelmingly refuted. Noting that the leaders of the Arizona Review had zero experience in election audits, the experts concluded, "We believe the Ninjas' announcement that they had confirmed to a high degree of accuracy the election results of one of the largest U.S. counties is laughable. Laughable or not, none of it changed the fact that Joe Biden won the state by about 10,500 votes and Maricopa County by roughly 45,000 votes in several official tallies of the vote. Katie Hobbs, the Democratic Secretary of State in Arizona, said the report's findings vindicated criticisms by the Cyber Ninjas process. It was clear from the start that the Cyber Ninjas were just making it up as they went along, Katie Hobbs said in a statement. I've been saying all along that no one should trust any results they produce, so it's no surprise their findings are being called into question. What can be trusted are actual election officials and experts, along with the official canvas of results. The inquiry into the election has been repeatedly condemned as a sham by election experts and denounced by the Republican-dominated Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, which oversaw the 2020 presidential vote. Critics note that the chief executive of Cyber Ninjas has spread false allegations that Arizona voting machines were rigged to ensure Donald Trump's defeat. The summer-long investigation was financed almost entirely by nearly $7 million in donations from Trump supporters. The experts based their conclusion on a worksheet containing a slice of the hand-count results that the Republican investigators published in the report on their inquiry. The worksheet shows that investigators counted 32,674 ballots in 40 of the 1,634 boxes of ballots they were reviewing. But official records show, and the investigators' own machine count of the 2.1 million ballots effectively confirms, that those 40 boxes actually contained 48,371 ballots, or 15,692 more ballots than were counted. The worksheet indicated that 9 of the boxes had not been counted at all, but even if those boxes were excluded from the tally, the count of the remaining boxes fell 4,852 ballots short of the correct total, according to the experts. The charge of a ballot undercount comes atop the debunking by experts and Maricopa County officials of virtually all of 22 implications of voting irregularities involving more than 50,000 voters in the Cyber Ninjas report. Among them, a claim that 23,400 mail-in ballots may have come from addresses that voters no longer occupied was based on research using a commercial address database that itself did not include 86,391 of the county's registered voters and, like most lists, relied on sources that are often inaccurate. It also ignored the fact that voters may legally cast ballots and then move on. And moving is common. More than 280,000 Maricopa County households moved in 2019 alone. Another claim that thousands of voters returned more ballots than they received misconstrued a data file that makes a new entry every time a damaged or incomplete ballot is corrected. Yet another claimed that precincts counted 836 more votes than were recorded ignored the fact that the records of some 3,600 voters, such as abused spouses and police officers, are not made public for security reasons. And an insinuation that 5,295 Maricopa County voters may have double voted because residents of other counties had the same names and birth years was spot-checked by county officials and found baseless. The outsiders were, in fact, other people. With similar reviews now set for Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Texas, it is increasingly clear that Arizona's partisan review succeeded while it failed, by amplifying baseless talking points while failing in any actual way to back up Donald Trump's claims of a rigged election. The Arizona Star reviews in other states seem likely to follow the same script with the blessing of the Republican political leaders who are promoting them, said Nata Persily, the Stanford University law professor, elections expert, and scholar of democracy. For those who are pushing the fraud narrative, the actual truth is besides the point, he said. The idea that the election was stolen is becoming a tribe-defining belief. It's not about proving something at this point, it's about showing fealty to a particular description of reality. Indeed, in the wake of the initial Cyber Ninjas report, Republicans in the Pennsylvania Senate only furthered their resolve to press ahead with a review of the election, one that includes a request for driver's license numbers and partial social security numbers of all 7 million Pennsylvania voters. The historic audit in Maricopa County is complete and significant findings have been brought to light, State Senator Doug Mastriano, a Republican and lead proponent of the election review, said in a statement last week. If these types of issues were uncovered in Maricopa County, imagine what could be brought to light from a full forensic audit in other counties around the United States, who process mass amounts of mail-in ballots. On Friday, 1st of October, Robin Voss, the Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, signed multiple subpoenas issued to the head of the Elections Commission in Milwaukee, the biggest city in the state and home to the largest concentration of Democratic voters, with a substantive request for documents including communication between the city and state election boards. Robin Voss, in an interview this week, reiterated his commitment to investigating the 2020 presidential election with a presumption that there were mistakes in the administration. "I think we kind of have to accept that certain things were done wrongly, figure out how to correct them, or else we'll never go to have public confidence," Mr. Voss said.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars, IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the speeches and thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two Islamic experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasem Muhammadi and Brother Ali Alavian. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum
assalam.
So in the series of the program Viewpoints regarding the speeches of the leader of Iran, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, we are mainly concerned with the role that the human beings might have in this life and how Islam and a religious leader like Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei look at human being in different aspects and dimensions. Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the important concept of progress and development as tackled by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. You know, when we talk about progress and development in today's world, the first things that comes to our mind is this technical development and the industrial progress and development that we see in today's world. I think sometimes, it needs a model, a new model. I mean, in order, because we have the teachings of Islam, mm-hmm. we have the modern developments and the progress over here.
Yeah.
There are some people needed who have mastery over both and can shape a kind of model for the Muslim societies, isn't it? What's your take on creating a kind of new model?
Definitely, Islam is not against development and, let's say, progress of the human being and whatever actually is regarding with the development, whether industrial or public welfare, whatever it is, and we are talking about. So it is 100% going with whatever Islam actually says. As for a model, I think the model has been introduced 14th century ago. Because when Islam came with a revolution against oppression, tyranny, and let's say lack of social justice. And this is what the, let's say, the lost element in the life of the human being, which was actually introduced there. We see that the Holy Prophet himself was working, and Imams of Ahlul Bayt, they have been working, and they were wealthy people. At the same time, they were doing infaq. They were giving alms to the needy. So it means that Islam wants us to work, to earn, to make money, and at the same time, consider the others. In order that no poor, no needy person exists in the society. So this model actually is the best model that
we are
after.
Isn't it very much idealistic look at the world, no poor living in the world? Because we could not see this even during the life of the prophets and the infallibles. You know, the poor were there and the riches getting richer. Brother, this is the problem. We have it from the first day of the world up to the end.
Look, brother, when we are talking about a model, I mean, theoretically, the model is available. Then this is another issue to see its realization is something else. As for the realization of it, so at the time of the Prophet, this Baytul Mal was actually distributed rightly among the people.
Whether the caliphs were the imam, of course, not the imams.
At the time of even Imam Ali al-Islam, it was, and what was the reason of martyrdom of Imam Ali al-Islam?
Mm-hmm.
So in this world, we are saying the model, the best model is available. But those who actually attacked this model and did not let this model to materialize, they were available 14 centuries ago, and they are available today.
Sometimes I myself, as a Muslim, as a Shiite Muslim living in Islamic Republic of Iran, think that we are playing in the same pitch, in the same field that the Western capitalism are playing. I mean, we are using the means and we are benefiting from them. And we say that we are working for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but we are preoccupied with them. Sometimes we lose the final cause and ground. And just look at these Muslim lands, which are very much developed around, especially in the Arab Peninsula, near the Arab countries. And all around, the rich becoming richer, the poor becoming poorer. This is the problem that the Muslim lands also have. I mean,
come on, brother. Do you really consider those a development? You know, being just,
I do want to say,
hanging on.
Yeah, I do want to say, although they are developed, technically speaking and industrially speaking, but the rich becomes richer and poor becomes poorer.
And at the same, I don't believe that they are developed, you know. Having money, you know, the petrol dollars and, you know, buying from that country and the other, it doesn't mean that they're developed. Yeah, you know, what I understand from development is it should be accompanied by dignity as well. So you are a developed person, you know, but the robot being controlled, a puppet being controlled by other countries, you know, not caring about your brothers, you know, other lands being actually wronged and being oppressed.
At least every state and country is affiliated with a power today in the world, whether it be the Arab countries who are affiliated with some part
that's
of the
exactly
West,
the,
or whether it be some of the countries of the Western...
That's exactly the kind of development that Islam is not actually ascribing, and, you know, and is actually going for and prescribing. So,
whether we want it or not, you know, this model needs to be defined.
Yeah.
Islamic Republic of Iran, I think, of course, it's in its very early stages, you know, after 42 years, it's only 42 years old, you know, a person is getting mature. But the case is that these role models and these models has to be created by the Muslims all around the world. Are we doing this based on the Islamic principles? Really? Do we do that?
You know, this is actually this is not what the claim of even the founders of the revolutions were and is actually now. What we have in the sayings of Imam Khomeini and Imam Khamenei, what they are actually going after is a Islamic civilization, and for sure we have not got there yet. And for sure, we are trying to, and actually we have a sort of plan for getting there. But, you know, you have to consider they are not just, you know, the power or the potential that you have. There are some, you know, impediments that may come into your path and to your way that halt you from getting there and being successful.
Right.
And there are many of them, actually.
Yes.
You know, falling on Iranian nation and the Iranian government.
All the truth seekers in the world.
Sorry,
okay.
I wanted to say that this was the mission of all the prophets from the beginning of the whole earth, the beginning of the history, from the prophet Adam till today. All the prophets came, as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Quran, that لَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا رُسُلًا بِالْبَيِّنَاتِ وَأَنزَلْنَا مَعَهُمُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْمِيزَانَ لِيَقُومَ النَّاسُ بِالْقِسْطِ.
That's right.
So look, all of them came to guide us, and at the same time, actually make social justice among the human being.
Okay.
So can we now criticize Prophet Nuh, let's say Noah, that why in your society this, let's say, distribution of wealth was not looked at, I mean, was not seen and was not observed? So we can simply answer you, brother, look, I tried my best, I brought the message, but the people who were in front of me, they did not let others to be benefited. The same comes in the course of history.
Brother, this is the question now, that sometimes we criticize the Western humanism and Western world for them being only developed in terms of,
criticize them in the sense that they are against this ideology, this worldview.
But at the same time, we lose the other side. We emphasize on the spiritual developments, and we lose the spiritual developments. At the same time, we do not have the bodily one. What's your answer?
Look, bro, if we lose a part of our mission, it has nothing to do with the theory itself, with the base and foundation itself. Okay. The base has no problem. Theoretically, it is correct in its place. But I was not a good person to function based on that. So it means I have not done my job well. So in case, like any other, let's say, believer or pious people, like prophets or, let's say, the imams, I have done my job in the right way, so the consequence of that would be a prosperous society with pleasure, worldly and, let's say, spiritually.
Now, and let alone those problems that have been made for prophets and actually are being made for a country, for an Islamic country like Iran, in order not to, you know, get to that at welfare that or development that you're talking about. Actually, at least me and my brother, we've been to other countries and we've been to Muslim countries, and the way that treats Iranians, you know, is outstanding. Why? Because even though that they know that we are, you know, we have some problems, they are familiar with the situation in Iran, they know that we are embargoed and sanctioned, there are many sanctions against us, but at the same time they know this, that when it comes to prioritizing, you know, which is the prior one, which one goes first, the dignity of a country, supporting, you know, a country, a Muslim country like Palestine, that are being, you know, oppressed by the Israelis, and having many problems, like, you know, having these sanctions that are halting them, that are, you know, impeding them from yes, getting to more development. Which one is more important? And they understand, you know.
This,
I mean,
independent identity and dignity you are referring to is very important. But the case is that in this global village that the peoples are today wearing with these mixed races, who's gonna you give originality? I mean, this is a very important question. And when you look at just the definitions that exist out of the religion of Islam in different schools of thought, which all of them believe we can get you successful and we can bring you success in today's world and the other world through this prescription and that prescription, I think this is a wrong attitude. We can get to the original source of Islam, the pure Muhammadan Islam, as said, the Ahlul Bayt one and the teachings, and that way it's possible, but I think it's very difficult to do.
It is quite, actually. Why is it difficult?
Because at the time of the infallible imams, they themselves were present and the people were not successful in doing so. I mean, at least the satanic powers did not let them, let alone to the modern world and the 21st century. I know the camp of Batil and Haq, both of them are working, challenging each other, okay? And the good people are acting, both heathenly speaking, and, you know.
So we can continue with whatever we have, then
yes,
we can leave alone whatever.
Let me ask you something. We're not any, you know, corrupt commander or, you know, an authority in the government of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. For sure there were many of them. Actually, we have some records that, you know, they were punished by Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So
the question is that the original theory is intact, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It is complete.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you say in terms of theory is good, but in terms of application, when it gets to the hands
so
of the people,
So we need to...
Okay, it will be wrong interpretation.
We need to think on the problems that we find in its application and materialization. Okay. So we have to resolve and actually solve those issues.
So act in a way that brings us both prosperity in this world and the hereafter.
So
and
we
this
have
is
to
difficult, you know?
And we have to remove the obstacles.
Yeah.
Well, obstacles are from actually two kinds. One external and some internal.
Yes.
Internal with the kind of, let's say, selfishness that me and the like of me have, actually.
Yes, here, theocracy, in the true sense of the word, if one rules over the world, where the people has to get back into their fitra, but we are busy so much with our surroundings in today's world, especially in the 21st century. You see how the media is working on the minds of the people. The people sometimes are forgetting themselves, let alone to think about the God inside themselves. So this is what the human beings are busy with in today's world. Shaykh Qasim Mohammadi and Ali Alavian, thank you much for your presence in the program Viewpoints.
Thanks to you, bro.
My pleasure.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us on Arab English Radio. This is Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en. Also visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Color of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you. Fi amanullah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in the world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
At the center of AUKUS are technologies like artificial intelligence, quantum, and cyber technologies. The United States, Britain, and Australia want to use these technologies to build a new kind of footprint in the Indo-Pacific. This makes AUKUS Pact a new technology-based geopolitical alliance, the first of its kind anywhere. And AUKUS has global implications. We now present you an article written by Abhishek Prakash, an authority on geopolitics of technology. The piece is titled What AUKUS Means for the World. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. During the Trump administration, a major development took place that went under the radar. Only months after taking office, former U.S. President Donald Trump and his officials started referring to the Asia-Pacific as the Indo-Pacific. This was not by accident. It was a highly strategic and calculated move, one that would kickstart new thinking in Washington. By using the phrase Indo-Pacific, the United States was simultaneously pointing to India's rise and placing new importance on a region that is rapidly becoming the world's new center of gravity. This phrase became even more official when the U.S. military renamed its Pacific Command to U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. Jump to 15th of September 2021, and the weight the U.S. is placing on the Indo-Pacific is visible to the world. When President Joe Biden, flanked by the leaders of Britain and Australia, announced AUKUS, a new defense alliance, something else became clear. The new U.S. geopolitical strategy for the next 50 years. That is, Western Europe and West Asia are no longer the priorities. Now Washington is placing all of its attention on and marshaling all of its resources towards dominating the Indo-Pacific. And to achieve this, the United States is turning to technology. At the center of the AUKUS Pact are technologies like artificial intelligence, quantum, and cyber technologies. The United States, Britain, and Australia want to use these technologies to build a new kind of footprint in the Indo-Pacific. This makes AUKUS a new technology-based geopolitical alliance, the first of its kind anywhere in the world. And the AUKUS Pact has global implications. But first, attention must be placed on how AUKUS is splitting the West. Already, France has accused the United States of stabbing it in the back. A $40 billion deal for Australia to acquire French submarines is now scrapped. The deal was referred to as the deal of the century. Through AUKUS, Australia will get nuclear-powered submarines from the United States and Britain. Meanwhile, the Canadian media are already questioning why Ottawa was excluded from the pact. Three Canadian government officials have said Canada was not even invited to the talks for AUKUS. And New Zealand has drawn a red line, saying Australian nuclear submarines will not be allowed in its territorial waters. Also expect reactions from Germany, the European Union, and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, all of which may feel the United States is no longer prioritizing European defense. However, regardless of how the West reacts, AUKUS is going ahead. A new technology-based beachhead is being built in the Indo-Pacific that will give the United States and its allies a purported new kind of power. While the first area of work for AUKUS is providing Australia with nuclear-powered submarines, the canvas of the alliance is much, much broader. With a focus on technologies like artificial intelligence and cyber technologies, the possibilities are endless. Could AUKUS establish a new artificial intelligence-based cybersecurity shield? or will AUKUS establish a new underwater surveillance system in the Indian Ocean using robots similar to what Russia is building? Equally important is what the new US-led geopolitical groups may morph into. Alongside AUKUS, there is the Quad, made up of the United States, India, Japan, and Australia. And US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said the Quad is far more than just a defense group. This leads to the possibility that the Quad might morph into the next G7, and AUKUS could morph into a new Asian NATO, or the next iteration of the Five Eyes intelligence sharing group. The creation of AUKUS is also a sign that globalization in its current form is ending. In the past, the US and the West created groups that involved everyone, such as the United Nations and the World Trade Organization, WTO. Now globalization is becoming vertical. With technology, the world is starting to divide and fracture. Governments are using technology to establish new walls and new barriers between themselves and the rest of the world. In the vertical world, the new groups only involve like-minded countries, not everyone. This creates a new limit for businesses. Some businesses originating from certain countries may be excluded from participating in the AUKUS Pact or Quad initiatives and projects. Last, as AUKUS takes its first step, it will not only remain in three-nation group. If the unstated goal is to take on China, the alliance has many options. AUKUS could invite Taiwan to the group, creating a new challenge for Beijing. Or AUKUS could invite Indonesia to join, a nation whose future power is largely ignored. By 2050, Indonesia will be the fourth largest economy in the world. Another way to use AUKUS is to interrupt China's Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI, especially the digital BRI, by involving Southeast Asian nations or strategically selecting nations in Central Asia and Eastern Europe. The creation of AUKUS comes at a time when the world is in a period of massive transformation, and it comes as every nation is trying to become a technology power. This new technology-based alliance fundamentally changes global politics. Now groups like the Group of Seven, the G7, or NATO carry less weight. And traditional US allies like Canada, France, and Germany are becoming outsiders looking in. With technology, AUKUS has the power to supposedly overcome challenges that have plagued other organizations. Whether it be ideology or territory, technology can transcend these differences and barriers. But more than anything else, AUKUS signals that a new race has begun, underpinned by technology. Except, if before this race was only between the United States and China, now it involves many more nations. With technology, the world is rapidly being divided into new tribes. The question is, can these tribes coexist with one another? And if not, what happens next? Prepare for a bumpy ride.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding.